look forward to talking to you all over the course of the next couple of days, especially about storage, a subject which is near and dear to my heart. Today, what I'd like to talk about is scale-out storage, particularly a variant of scale-out storage that I call symmetric scale-out storage. And I want to break it down into various categories. I need to stand someplace else.
You have to be behind the speakers, otherwise it's going to be really feedback.
Very good. All right. I'm standing all the way back here. So I'm going to break this down into a few sections. So first of all, in some sense, scale-out storage is a realization of a dream in the virtualization of storage. I want to introduce the topic by talking about that. Talk about the economics behind scale-out and why scale-out's becoming a powerful force in storage. The decisions that you take on when you decide you want to build a scale-out system. I want to talk about what's difficult about building scale-out systems and maybe prompt some ideas in all of us about directions where this could go in the future. And then along those lines, talk about open scale-out questions. So there are many things that are still make scale-out an imperfect illusion. And then lastly, enormous data stores open new questions for us that maybe have more to do with data than storage itself. I want to finish by talking about that. So when you think about virtualization in general is the creation of something that's not a physical thing that seems to be like a physical thing. And storage, in data storage, we've talked about virtualization for a long time, and people's ideas about what that means are very different. Most frequently, virtualization storage refers to the aggregation of many things and turning them into something that looks like a single thing. But there are different sides to this. Virtualization can also be the creation of a large thing and carving it up into little things. The part of data storage that I work in, file storage, is a process of taking a large container of data. I need to not hit that button. A large container of data and breaking it up into little pieces. Right. So I would argue that a traditional file system is a virtualization of a storage container. So files are objects that I can read and I can write at random locations, and they allow me to subdivide a large resource into smaller resources, and thereby make better use of this large container. Now, the notion of not subdividing a large container into smaller ones seems ridiculous, and possibly then it's not a surprise that even the hierarchical file system was invented 49 years ago. So hierarchical file systems first appeared in the context of Multics, a predecessor to Unix. Notably, in the paper where they describe the hierarchical file system, R.C. Daly and P.G. Newman make this comment that I find fascinating. The user is given the illusion that the capacity of file storage is infinite. So 49 years ago, these guys were building a system for people to share. And they realized that presenting the illusion of an infinite resource is key to usability, right? So they understood, almost a half century ago, what a prime motivator was for what became scale-out storage. So file storage is a subdivision of a large container into smaller ones. Now, there's another area where we divide large containers into smaller ones a lot, and that's machine virtualization. So for the last 10 or 15 years, we've been taking servers and saying, it's not enough that we have a single machine running on that. We should be able to have 10 or 100 or 1,000 machines running on that. But those virtual servers, I would argue, are fundamentally different from files in a really important way. And that important way is that servers have associated with them an IP address. And I see IP as sort of the universal resource bus in the modern age, right? IP addresses or domain names or whatever are how I go and get resources. So I can take a virtual machine that's running inside a hypervisor. I can pick it up and I can move it to another hypervisor. And everyone who is interacting with that machine can continue on interacting with it unaware that the location of this resource has changed, right? It's an active resource. But files are different from that. Even though they're a virtualization where we've subdivided a container into smaller containers, you can't pick them up willy-nilly because they're tied into a namespace that's associated with their enclosing container. So this is rather like traditional disks, right? There's no way to access a disk on a network. Well, that's patently not true, right? Because I can do that via fiber channel or iSCSI, but in the traditional direct access or DAS mode, there was no way to do that. So there's this interesting problem where the lack of addressability of individual files leads us to want to construct ever larger containers to hold them, right? I don't want to have multiple containers for files because if I do that, I need to keep track of where they are. So the desire for ever larger containers led us, starting in the 1970s, to start aggregating individual physical resources into ever larger virtual resources. So RAID has been around in one form or another since the 1970s, striping across multiple devices, mirroring devices for protection, et cetera. So these technologies allow us to to protect our data and also create a larger data store and also a higher performance data store. But it's higher performance hardware and it's more reliable hardware. So this stuff is going to be the most basic obvious stuff to everyone in this room because it's pretty obvious that there's a problem here and the problem lives right in the middle, right? File system and controller in this world of virtualization is a problem. It's clearly still a physical resource. It doesn't scale and it's not fault tolerant. So easy, not fault tolerant, not scalable. 20 years ago or so, maybe 30 years ago, I'm not sure, we started introducing high availability pairs. And these groupings of controllers and file systems could probably entirely hide what happens when machines fail from us, right? Which is a great step forward because at least it meant we had reliable systems, but we still didn't have scalable systems. So scale out is the process, one way or another, of breaking this last bottleneck, right? This last thing that stops us from having this perfect virtualization of a single storage system, which works around this file art problem and allows storage to grow indefinitely. So when you want to take a piece of computation and scale it out, hopefully you have a lot of parallel demand for the resource, and you also have a lot of parallel supply for the resource. In this picture, you tend to have many clients and many disks, and so you know that it's possible to take that computation and scale it out across multiple machines, right? That's usually the thing that you need to have present in order to affect one from many virtualization. So this is what scale out is. So I'm going to get a glass of water here. So it's great that we can take systems and we can scale them, or that we've realized this is a bottleneck and we're going to address it. Who cares about this? Who cares about this problem right now? Why should we care? It's pretty much compulsory when you're in my position to have some slide that wows the audience with the amount of data that we have and how fast it's growing. So I thought I would take a contrarian perspective today and talk about how little data we have. So if every bit in the world were a carbon atom, we'd have about a gram of carbon. So there's so much left to store, looked at another way. So we're getting close to a mole of data. If you took the photographs on my hard drive and you multiplied them by 7 billion people, we'd have 60 nuclear reactors whose raison d'etre was to spin hard disk drives. Not very exciting, especially if you saw my pictures. But our data's doubling every 2 years, and that leads to very interesting economics. So I talk every week to people who are deploying storage, and their growth rates of storage vary from 10 to 20% year over year to 300% year over year. So they're all faced with some variant of this curve. So over time, the theoretical minimum capacity they could be deploying at that time is growing. It doesn't look like a straight exponential like this graph does. It's ups and downs. But if you apply a great enough smoothing function, it's probably going to look like this with some base for almost everyone that I talk to. And when they consider how to plan deploying storage, they're faced with a choice. They can either, these words say monolithic overprovisioning. So they can either choose that, monolithic overprovisioning. So I decide, I sit down and I make a prediction for the next 5 years about how much storage I think I'm going to need. Capacity, compute, network, et cetera. And I buy the appropriate filer or storage system for that purpose. Or instead I say, I don't want to know right now what I'm going to need for this project, or I don't want to decide yet. I'm just going to deploy in small increments over time. So visually it's very obvious what the difference is, right? In this world, I have to dedicate a lot of resources to a project that in the incremental space spend case, I wouldn't have to. So why would I not want to take all that money and dedicate it to something that I'm not using yet? Well, the answer to that is pretty straightforward, right? When I park cash into a project, then I'm wasting money one way or another. So I can take that money and I can spend it on that, but I could have used that money. You know, I could have put it in a bank account. If we put it in mine, I think I would get, you know, 0.01% interest. But let's just imagine that an organization has better uses for capital than putting it into a machine that's not getting used yet. It may be that I pay extra electricity consumption associated with resources that I only need in the future. So the main point here is the world's becoming lean. So one of the big manufacturing trends or industrial process trends of the last 40 years is that we're figuring out ways to only bring inventory to bear on problems at the point when that inventory is needed, right? It makes us more efficient and it lets us do more with the capital that we have available. So traditional storage purchasing, which is 5-year cycle, is distinctly unlean. Now, you might be saying, yeah, but I could add shelves of disks along the way. Totally true, right? That problem was solved in the 2000s. I didn't have to buy all my disks up front, right? And that was a great step forward. So for those sorts of systems, this is largely an issue for, as I say, network, CPU, RAM, et cetera, other components of your hardware system. So because this isn't lean, I have a bunch of other problems associated with monolithic planning, right? Beyond just the, I applied money to this problem before I needed to do so, we have to realize that the projects that we apply storage to are inherently unpredictable. We can't know if I start a new website or something and I want to project in 5 years how many users I'm going to have. This is risible, right? It's a total joke to think that I could know how fast I'm going to grow. So project failure, right? My startup was a flop. Leads to an enormous gap between my capital investment and the actual utility that I gained from it, right? Big problem. And then there's a success disaster version of this thing as well. If I structured what I'm doing around a notion that in 5 years I'm going to be upgrading the storage system and then it happens in 3, that's a different kind of problem, and it's also a problem. And here's the real killer. So we talked about the reasons why tying up capital in a pre-buying situation is a problem. That problem gets a lot worse when you consider that hardware grows cheaper by, give or take, a factor of 2 every 2 years. So you can look at that 2 ways. I could get twice as much stuff in 2 years for the same money, or I could get the same stuff for half as much. It's more commonly the former than it is the latter. But either way, if you factor in the declining cost of hardware, and what you see is that monolithic overspend not only starts out tying up a bunch of money, but by the end of the lifetime of your project, you've spent, you know, 2x or more than you actually needed to spend over the course of the life of the project. So it otherwise stated, you know, day one, I spent $5 per gigabyte or something, or $5 per gigabyte or something, and I had gotten to the point where only 1 out of every $2 I had was wasted by the end of a 5-year period, whereupon I was out of capacity again, need to make another investment, and I'm off by a factor of five again, right? So the fundamental problem here is there's a theoretical optimal place, which is where I can buy storage by the bit and by the IOP at exactly at the time it's needed, right? And the closer that I can fit to that curve, the more effective I become, right? The more capital effective I become. And this is primarily driven by the fact that hardware declines in price over time. So these are actual numbers. This isn't a pretend graph. This graph is based on the assumption of a 2x decrease in hardware cost and 2x increase in demand every 24 months. So given that story, the answer seems obvious, right? We need to get to the point where we're buying in small increments, right? And decide how much waste we want to have in the course of our business, and then buy as frequently as possible or as frequently as necessary to accomplish that goal. So a bunch of problems emerge in traditional file storage with this approach. The first problem is, if I'm using traditional file systems, every year or so, I'm deploying a new filer. Every time I deploy a new filer, probably I have a new namespace associated with that filer, and I have to keep track of where things are. Second problem is, every time I deploy a new filer, the other filers are at this point full, and I'm writing primarily to this new filer. It becomes the hot storage. All of this storage that I deployed in the past, which is sitting there full, was expensive storage, right? It was storage that I bought because it could handle the entirety of my workload in terms of writes anyway. And then when it gets full, I just let it sit there, right? I've got two choices. I can either figure out a way to migrate that now cold data into some cheaper place, which is painful because it's a storage migration, or I can just let it sit there on this expensive resource. Adding insult to injury, it's not the case that data never gets deleted. It's mostly true that data never gets deleted, but it's not entirely true. And so you can end up with stranded extra capacity hanging out in your environment. And so keeping track of all of this, capacity issues is rather complicated. It results in underutilization. It results in buying storage that's more powerful than is strictly necessary, and a lot of complexity. Bear in mind that I may have thousands of servers and thousands of clients in my environment. If I really am adding new places for data all the time, then I'm dealing with complexity that fans out to the entire edge of my infrastructure environment. So the alternative, the sort of the monolithic buying world, if I'd bought a monolithic system, maybe I didn't have to deal with all that extra complexity. We know it's really expensive, we just talked about it, but maybe I didn't have to deal with all that complexity. But I still need to, at the end of the life cycle of that system, I still need to deal with grabbing all of that data and moving it to the new giant system, right? Where the waste begins anew. These monolithic systems have the advantage where it's easy to keep track of where my data is, and maybe it's I don't end up with as much of a hotspot problem, but I still have to grab all my data and move it. So simple, right? So the economics of scale out really is that it's an embodiment of lean in storage. So it allows us to, over time, increment capacity without adding namespaces. So the entire periphery of the network just knows about the location of the data, right? All the data lives in one place, and all of the workload is applied to all of the storage resources in the environment. So why does scale-up matter? It matters because it minimizes IT overspend, eliminates storage migrations, provides a single namespace for data, reduces performance hotspots, and it allows late bound decisions, right? It accommodates all of the variability that I may encounter in the course of doing whatever project or business I'm doing. So next I'd like to talk about the decisions that you have to make when you decide that you want to build a scale-out system. Given that there are such powerful economic drivers for centralizing storage and doing so in an effective way, you'd expect that there would be a variety of different approaches people have tried to get there. And So I want to cover some of those decision points and talk about the thing that I have personally seen work in industry. So first off, I can build, this is fairly, just a disclaimer that I should have made a while ago. I really am. You know, I have a deep background in file storage, and I tend to think about things through file storage lens. And this is very much a file-focused question. Do I end up with local file systems or software that I install on clients and servers in order to know how to get to storage? Or do I just leverage NFS and SMB and use those that existing installed software base to access data? There are advantages and disadvantages to each of these. So if I use this local file system approach, I get to scale the CPU that's applied to the file system with the number of clients and servers out there. That's pretty cool. In addition, it means that everything on the edge of the network knows exactly how to get to the data that it needs, right? Because there is communication about where data lives, each individual server or client can basically send a packet straight there saying, hey, go get me this data, or I want to modify the contents of this data, or whatever. So it cuts out redirection. The downside is that if you do that in a really high-performance way, it's possible that you expose the metadata associated with your file store to corruption by any participant in the file system, right? So creating a trusted wall around your scale-out system is sort of desirable, and this is possibly a downside, especially in high-performance installations. So on the distributed file system side, I talk to storage via NFS or SIFS, and in a scale-out system, it's quite possible that I connect to a host that doesn't own my data. And in the limit, it is 100% the case that I connect to a host that doesn't own my data, and then it needs to turn around and go get that data for me. So clearly, there's a middle ground here with PNFS, et cetera, where we try and solve this problem by having smarter client protocols. We haven't seen a lot of industry penetration of PNFS yet, and so that's sort of not, that doesn't factor into my world very much. Next question that that we have building a scale-out system is you see a bifurcation of architectures around what I call asymmetric versus symmetric scale-out. And really, this is do I integrate metadata or information about where the files live with the rest of the data store so that every host in the system is both keeping track of where files live and also keeping track of file data? Or do I separate out those two functions? Again, there are pluses and minuses with both of these approaches. When I build a symmetric system, that is, it integrates metadata with everything else, I have the advantage that the entire system, or all of the storage, can be used to deal with metadata operations or data operations. That's an advantage. In the asymmetric case, maybe I build a custom system where all of the indexing lives on extremely hot storage and all the rest of it lives on cold storage. It gives me more programmability. The other nice thing about asymmetric systems is they may well leave an artifact on every place where the data lives, where if the whole system falls apart, I can still go back and get my data, right? It's a little easier to reason about them. And the evolution of systems where data is separated from metadata, there's an element of taking things that we already have and trust and reusing them so that if things really fall apart, I can still get back my data in some way, shape, or form. Next question that people try to answer building these systems is whether to integrate file system and volume manager. So in the old days, we would, without question, choose what file system we were going to use and then choose what volume manager we were going to use, and then put it together in this entirely virtualized software system. The problem with keeping these two things separate is that the interface between them is incredibly narrow. So if all we talk about when we talk about volume managers is reads and writes to specific offsets in a disk, it's very limiting the sorts of information that you can communicate and then the sorts of functionality that you can provide. So for example, if the volume manager says, hey, I'm a thin provision volume manager And I noticed that there's, you know, there are two blocks of data sitting in this 8 gigabyte chunk, and I want to go tell that file system, hey, go evacuate that thing off of there, right? Go, I need you to go move these blocks, et cetera, right? It's very hard for these, for separate components that are produced by different vendors to cooperate and work together to accomplish, you know, the goals that they each may have, one dealing with the storage layer, another dealing with the file layer. Likewise, it's hard for a file system to query information that that maybe only the lower level systems, lower levels of the system know. So one example is, you imagine you have a ZFS file system. The ZFS file system detects, you imagine ZFS running on a SAN, for example. Forget the integrated protection. So it realizes that one of the checksums doesn't add up, right? So I've got a link in the tree and the checksum doesn't add up, and I say, okay, this is a problem. Let me go ask the volume manager if it can reconstruct that data from different protection variants, right? Maybe it's +2 data protected, and I want to read every possible interpretation and see if there's one of them where the checksum is right, right? And that will tell me, okay, there was something wrong. This form of communication gets lost between a file system and a volume manager with a narrow read-write interface. When I think about how to distribute the data itself among nodes, people have taken different approaches. It's sometimes the case that people will take a file system tree and say, okay, I'm going to, with as few cuts as possible, make it so the cuts jump across from storage system to storage system, right? So I actually carve up a namespace so that it lives between storage systems. And then I need to go through a process of constantly rebalancing what data lives on what storage system. As some get full and some get empty. In some sense, it's a pretty elegant way of approaching this problem. There's still a problem where, because there's locality between where things reside and representation in the tree, then hotspots in the tree can result in hotspots in underlying storage. Should we ditch shared storage altogether? So this notion of traditional high availability pairs usually rely on each of the hosts being able to see all of the storage. That happens to be really effective. It's very cost effective in small installations because it means you can use large RAID stripes when you only have two hosts present. But at the same time, from a strictly practical perspective, a lot of people don't enjoy managing separate redundant storage networks. So simply using DAS on hosts becomes an option when you do scale out. If I have 10 nodes in a scale out system, I can just use DAS for each one of them, and it simplifies life quite a bit. So my experience has been that if you're building a product and you want to sell it to people in a turnkey sort of way and solve a problem for them, you have to sort of reduce every element of friction that exists in that process, right? If I'm so, let me put it this way: if I'm looking for a replacement for my current filer, right? Then I'm looking for a replacement for my current filer. I want something that acts basically the same way. I don't want to change the way I'm doing things. I'm going to look for the best thing that does the same thing as the thing that I'm replacing. If I'm building a new high-performance computing installation, I think I'm going to look at it and say, what's the best way I can bring the most performance to bear? For the least amount of outlay, probably in hardware, and I'm willing to change a lot of things about what I'm doing in order to get there. So in my world, what I've seen is that symmetric integrated file system, shared nothing, distributed, tends to result in one thing to manage and scale. And the relevance of that isn't just people being lazy, or it's not at all people being lazy. It comes back to when I want my storage to fit the theoretical minimum line for resource allocation, right? When I want to be able to buy in small increments and do the right thing over time, then you're, by definition, making a lot of changes to your storage environment over time. And it better be really easy to do everything that you need to do along the way. Because when you try and fit that demand curve, what you need to have people do is make tens or hundreds of adjustments to their storage infrastructure over a period of years rather than a single upfront decision, right, that lasts for many years. And so any decision you can make where you simplify that tends to win in the marketplace. So Separate from that, distributed blocks, so actually spreading blocks rather than file across elements in a scale-out system tends to reduce hotspots just because you don't end up with areas of the tree that are hot resulting in individual filers that are hot. And then last, POSIX file systems, so hierarchical file systems. Again, a point of friction. It's easier for people to drop something in that works exactly the way they're used to. And there are standards, and they are, you know, maybe sometimes they look a little bit long in the tooth, but it's great to support them exactly. So a typical symmetric shared nothing scale out. So this a system may look like this. Multiple nodes in the system, each one has direct attached storage. There's file system and volume manager that are tightly coupled inside any individual node. And collectively across all the machines, they create a distributed computer. On top of that, you have access protocols, which hopefully are standardized. And then on top of that, a virtualized front-end network. So you need to have a virtualized front-end network, otherwise the illusion is broken. You want everything, back to the theme of virtualization, you want everything to look like a single enormous file storage system. So at this point, I'd like to talk about what's difficult about scale-out. There are a lot of things about scale-out that are very hard to get right, and a lot of things to go wrong along the way, starting with commitment. So distributed systems, there's a long history of research into, particularly from the database world, into how to do commitment. So the basic problem is that in a scale-out system, you need to have multiple places where data is stored that are agreeing on what the state of the world is, right? So it could be that a single file is striped across many machines. Any way you look at it, you want to end up with a situation where everyone agrees that a certain point in time has been reached in a storage system, and that, in addition, anything that you told the outside world had been committed, in fact, was committed. So this is especially difficult to do in a low-latency way in distributed systems. So the atomic commitment protocols involve round trips between individual elements in a system. All of those round trips sort of stack up and lead to latency problems that I'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation. So beyond it, as if getting it right and getting it reasonably low latency weren't hard enough, in addition, you have to be able to scale to millions of transactions per second, right? So there need to be no contention points in a distributed transaction system that's handling millions of transactions per second. Also along the lines of round trips and RPCs in scale-out systems, this RPC intensity sort of drives a demand for every resource that is acquired by an RPC to be cacheable in a system. So, and unfortunately, there are many of these, particularly in the world of file systems. So, it may be that I find it unacceptable that I'm going to do an RPC to allocate space to place a block on a remote node in a system. It may be the fact that I'm repeatedly accessing the same file through the same location in the system, and I don't want to keep going out and getting the same lock over and over again. This block contents is the obvious one. We always cache data. Key caches, event. I'll talk about events in a little bit, quota levels. There are an arbitrary number of these things. To create the illusion of a giant filer, we have to be able to tolerate all sorts of different faults. Network disconnects, switches fail, individual nodes fail, software may crash, et cetera. So an enormous amount of work goes into scale out to make it so that arbitrary failures can't break the illusion of a single filer that keeps on running. So to add to that, in the file domain, there are many mechanisms for concurrency control that we have to deal with. On the SMB side, this is for Windows interop, you deal with these things called oplocks, which are like NFS delegations, which allow clients to cache dirty data and clean data without those things becoming invalid, or with sort of a reasonable guarantee about how long they need to check out for before those things become invalid. There are mandatory locks, bite range to, you know, again, add insult to injury. So these locking domains pretty much require that you implement distributed deadlock detection inside file storage, right, if you want to do it right, because you can return, you can return deadlock errors to clients. Share mode locks, so especially locking in Windows is really complicated. There are, I don't know how many it is, somewhere between 10 and 20 different types of lock that you can acquire a file with. So whereas you may be used to POSIX locking, where it's lock read, lock write, you can also lock for delete and lock for rename and lock for, you know. So the a complicated story with locking. All of these things need to become distributed concepts. The NFS side, probably people know more about delegations, NFS locking. So many domains that you have to support. Events inside file systems, I usually envision a file system as being a notion where outside the immediate domain, there is no sense of hierarchy, right? You don't expect to be in a situation where you have to know that you are some distant descendant of some higher up parent in a file system. Yet this turns out not to be true. In order to implement change notify for Windows interoperability, you need to know that a certain file lives underneath a certain directory so that you can report events. So I can register a listener, say, on home, and then expect that I hear about modifications to files B or C or some child of B or C, but not hear about events that are happening on A. Again, this needs to happen in a distributed context. So when we build scale-out in a distributed way, that is, we use NFS or SIFS to access data, this mostly requires that individual elements of a scale-out system are transferring data back and forwards between themselves. And this requires a lot more east-west bandwidth than other architectures do. So a typical approach is to plug every node in a scale-out system into a fully non-blocking switch fabric. So tens of thousands of nodes of scale-out at 10 gigabit drive the need for a 100 terabit fabric on connecting all of those nodes. So open questions in scale-out. So there are a lot of, I think I've sort of alluded to problems that we haven't really solved yet and that are open, and where the payout for solving them sort of driving this very easy to use symmetric scale-out illusion closer to the efficiency of maybe less well virtualized asymmetric systems. So if you take this picture of a symmetric scale-out system that I drew earlier and you look at what happens in the process of handling a single write, you see that there are many steps, and many of those steps involve network traversal in some form or another. So an incoming NFS write may enter a file system. It may do lock traffic or event traffic or quota traffic or anything else. Again, drives the need for caching. And then at some point, requests get fanned out into individual block requests that are spread out across this fabric. So this looks really heavyweight, right? And it's easy to get into a situation where individual writes in a symmetric scale-out system look pretty heavyweight. They're expensive, take a long time to complete. You can't respond to the request until every single sub-request has been delivered and acknowledged. So open question here is, how much of this can we get rid of? One non-obvious thing about this is, if what I'm distributing here are blocks, then on every single write, theoretically, I need to update the data that was referenced. And I also need to update all of the protection data associated with that data. So if I have a certain number of data elements in a stripe and a certain number of protection elements in a stripe, then I need to send information about updates to all the protection elements in addition to all of the data elements. So there's an open question here about beyond just getting, my understanding is that PNFS would be a great way to get the data sent to the right place, but even that doesn't solve necessarily if I'm running protection across many nodes in scale-out. I still need to get the protection data to the right place. So I'm curious about whether there are ways to improve this situation so that we don't have all the east-west traffic that we have today associated with this. The read case is basically similar to this, but I only have to get data from one place. And the answers to how to optimize this in symmetric scale-out seem more obvious, right? I mean, this path where I receive a request, I do whatever locking is necessary, and then I send out a read request, go pick up the data, and then the data comes back, and I send it back out again. We have a situation where the data traverses the network twice, or some network twice, and in addition, it then goes back. And then there are also all the requests going across the network associated with that. So being able to close the loop and do direct server return or something like that in this context is very interesting, right? How would we get to the place where this node in a scale-out system could respond directly out and close the loop that way and thus eliminate that extra hop? There are a lot of problems associated with doing that. SMB, for example, is a connection-oriented protocol. NFSv3 is a connection-oriented protocol. Being able to insert directly into the sequence space of that connection would be highly desirable. But obviously, there's lots to go wrong when I try to do that. Saying that, you know, sending a request that says, "Hey, I've reserved this area of the sequence space for you to respond to this. Go do it directly." As I say, there's a lot to go wrong there. So. Other problems in symmetric scale-out. So flows aren't really portable. So if I have some connection that's hanging out on a certain machine, and I decide because I want to rebalance or something, but I just want to rebalance a single client connection, this is very difficult for us to do. What I would need to do in order to affect that is, if I were using an IP load balancer, I would need to say, "Hey, this particular flow I would like to have redirected now." And in addition, I want to grab all of the application state associated with that and all of the IP state and make sure that the new place where that flow is moving to is ready to receive that flow. So in order to affect fine-grained load balancing in scale-out systems, which is very desirable to create a better illusion of a large filer, we would need a lot of interaction between IP load balancer, application level programming, and then also kernel level IP state and TCP state. If we do that in addition, and we can migrate all of the flows around, then that opens the door for us to perform software upgrades on machines where client connections are present. So we can grab everything and then update the software and then move the flows back afterwards. And so this would provide for completely non-disruptive software upgrades. Now, in terms of physical machine maintenance, we could encapsulate the top levels of this stack inside a virtual machine container and migrate the virtual machine around. And then we would have ability to do physical maintenance, but we would still have the problem of rebooting the contents of that virtual machine container. So there are partial solutions to this that involve virtualization. And the complete solution probably involves a much more powerful flow migration concept. Scaling down. So scale out was born because people needed to store a lot of data in various contexts. HPC, media and entertainment for the company that I worked at doing scale out. Ended up being a big driver. Suddenly, people need to store a lot of data. But there's an effective lower limit when you do symmetric scale out and how many nodes that you need to have in a system, and that effective lower limit is 3. And so there's a question of, can we build a system where it can seamlessly migrate from being a shared disk architecture up into being a scale out system? And then beyond that, can you migrate from being a single disk system into a monolithic system that that can survive the loss of a disk but not a controller, into something that can survive the loss of the controller, into something that scales out. So having some rather complicated set of software stages that let you do that is one approach to doing this. There are other approaches that we can take in symmetric scale out. We can just reduce the number of disks per node in the system. It looks sort of sad and lonely. this tiny little bit of disk attached to all of this complexity. And you know, as you would expect, the cost of compute components associated with those nodes pretty quickly starts to dominate the storage cost. And so these approaches don't really make sense. Another thing that that's a sort of a object of curiosity right now that I'm very, you know, I think could turn into something is taking the lower levels of a scale-out stack and pushing them into logic that lives inside disk drives themselves and attaching those to redundant networks. So if we could drive the cost of, you know, CPU and a little bit of RAM and ability to do a distributed transaction into a disk drive, we could attach those to redundant networks of some variety and then scale out our systems one drive at a time instead of one node at a time. Blast radius. So I've been in the situation before of talking to people about how large they would like to make their scale-out systems, and people tend to be conservative, and they'll say things like, well, I'm gonna break it into 100 terabyte chunks, or I think I'm gonna break it into whatever size chunks it is. And the fundamental problem here is distrust. And that distrust is that there are, you know, in a system that has 1,000 elements, it just, maybe there's a way that it just takes one to bring the whole thing down, right? And so I want to constrain the scope of a disaster if it were to happen. So scale-out systems are designed to withstand the loss, the actual, you know, the physical destruction of a single node, but maybe the whole system can't withstand a software error on one of those systems. Maybe I leak a lock, or drive becomes slow, or something like this, and it takes down the whole system effectively. So ideally, the property of a perfectly virtualized large filer would be that any of the individual elements we can reason about and have a high degree of certainty that no software error on that system can result in a loss of liveness of this scale-out system. I have no idea how to do this. And following along from that, that's sort of the volatile version of the problem. The non-volatile version of the problem is the data structures that we use to store the data themselves, the file system, et cetera. There are a lot of individual links that are very high value in those file systems, right? The individual directory entry for the home directory on a 10 petabyte system, assuming there's a lot of stuff underneath home, is a very high value link, right? It's another thing that makes building very large systems very scary, and something where I think we could get better at having a lot of confidence that you can't destroy the data structure with a single accident. So when we get to the place where we have robust data structures and commodity hardware, that feels like the place where that people are envisioning a software-defined storage. I'm not going to comment on what a definition of that would be. I think that we have a very learned group of people talking about it tomorrow, but that seems like the way that we a critical element of that notion. Along the lines of software-defined storage, this doesn't strictly have to do with scale-out, but it's very relevant right now. For a very long time, when you buy an enterprise-grade storage system, you're buying a big pile of commodity hardware that has been excruciatingly well-qualified, plus a little bit of hardware special sauce, which is an NVRAM. So there are two things if we really want to build robust large-scale systems on top of commodity hardware, two things need to happen. One, we need to find a new source of low-latency commits. So we need to be able to write data into the system, have it acknowledged quickly, and feel good about the robustness of that. And then separately, our software needs to be really good at tolerating hardware that lies to us. Hardware is not very trustworthy in my experience. So the reason we do all the qualification is to compensate for hardware lying, and then we have NVRAMs in addition to that. So so there's a question here about where does this new source of low latency commits come from? And the enthusiasm around NAND flash and PCM and MRAM and what have you, I guess the question here is, what is the server that I'm going to buy from Dell? What does that look like such that I have a source of low latency commits in it, right? Because it's going to happen at some point. It'll become, I believe, an essential feature of much server hardware because I want to run storage on server hardware. So what form is that going to come in? So lastly, I'd like to talk about things that break at scale. So for the last 10 years, we've been great at starting to build systems that could scale very, very large. And what I see when I talk to people who are deploying large amounts of data is that this opens the door to new problems, right? So we've gotten pretty good at creating systems that scale. But there are things that we're not good at yet. The first is that when I only had monolithic file aheads, I could run software against or on those file aheads. And reason that I could sequester a reasonable proportion of all of the capacity of that thing by running a single process or a single multi-threaded process or something doing some data-related activity. And in a scale-out system, that's absolutely not true, right? I need to actually have parallelism, right? So witness the emergence of MapReduce, et cetera, right? As a, you know, there aren't single-threaded ways of doing a lot of things. Yet, a lot of data management techniques in the data storage world are still effectively single-threaded. So if I want to back up data, it's not okay to back up data coming from a single node and going to a single tape. All of these things need to become concurrent. If I want to migrate data out to the cloud, you need to have multiple sources and multiple endpoints. And this applies to 100 different things people do to manage data. Rsync and CP and tar and sneakernet, tiering, everything else. So there's an incredible amount of pain right now in the world of people deploying data storage associated with getting data moved, right? It seems like a pretty straightforward problem. There's a lot of pain around this. Volume-based concepts are too coarse. So NetApp introduced practical snapshots in the 1990s for people to use. It's great functionality. It allows you to get a point-in-time consistent backup. It allows users to go recover data that they accidentally deleted, et cetera. In a world where my file systems are multiple petabytes, it doesn't make sense to have snapshots that cover the entire file system anymore, right? So I want to have the illusion of a single thing for the sake of manageability, right? Back to 1964 Multics, right? The illusion of infinite scale. But data manageability doesn't make sense at that granularity. So these concepts have to get revisited in order to continue to allow data storage to be manageable. Same thing applies to quotas. Do you want to encrypt your entire system with the same keys? Does that make sense? How do you do isolation in a gigantic virtualized store? and tiering preferences, et cetera. Pretty much every data management technology that we've grown accustomed to using starts to break down at very large scale. And then data management itself. So the process of understanding what data I have what's getting used, or what's hot, or where the performance is going, how much data exists under a certain directory. Any of these things, we've traditionally used data management tools in file system context that are effectively single-threaded. And those things clearly don't scale at all. I was speaking with someone recently managing a great deal of data, and he said, so what my life is like is every week I come to work, and I hear about another person who's using the storage, who is evangelizing the parallel tree walker that they wrote for storage this week, right? So, and every one of those new parallel tree walkers, people are free to access storage however they want, and so every new tree walker is visiting every single file in the system, right? And the reason is that if they visited them sequentially, they would be taking 10 days or a week or 3 weeks or whatever to get that information. So all of the ways that we have of gaining an understanding of the data that's stored in the system are incredibly performance intensive, and none of the traditional ones work particularly well at very large scale. So I'd like to conclude. Due to the data growth and Moore's law, scale out's an efficiency technology. So growth is really what drives scale out and makes it compelling, more so than simple scale. There are lots of different ways to build scale-out. They solve different problems. In my world, the simplest thing that you can possibly deliver is the thing that's going to win. We need new approaches to sort of complete the illusion of a single giant ever-growing file storage system or storage system. And then lastly, as I see it, we're moving beyond the time when managing the storage is the principal problem. Managing the data and the movement of data and understanding what's in the data is moving into the forefront as the biggest problem associated with large-scale storage. So with that, I'd want to thank you all for being here and open the floor to any questions.
We have time for a couple of questions. If you want to ask, I would actually encourage people to just go to the mic and ask questions.
Thanks for the presentation.
Thanks, Ramesh.
Yeah. So I want to get your views on PNFS a little bit more. I'm not an expert in PNFS, but
as aren't I.
Oh, I think you probably know better. It seems to me that it does solve some of the problems that you were referring to. For mm-hmm. example, with respect to direct data access from the client directly to the node that holds the data. And you said that you're not that interested in it because it hasn't taken off, but I'm wondering whether there are fundamental reasons why it has not taken off, or it just happens to be the case.
Well, great question. So, as I say, I'm not a PNFS expert, and the way I understand the situation is this. I don't know of widely used Windows implementations of PNFS. Maybe they exist. I'm not sure. But there's the first part of it is a lot of the world is Windows, and clearly you're thinking about NFS in a Linux client perspective, presumably, or Unix client perspective. I think that what you see is. If I do start using PNFS, also as I understand it, I really don't want to say something ignorant about PNFS, but as I understand it, it's sort of an all or nothing proposition, right? I have to, if I want to start distributing all my data via PNFS, then everything needs to be PNFS to see the big picture of that, right? And so interoperation in a world with NFS v3 is going to be a little bit of a challenge and Windows file share, et cetera. And then beyond that, I think just that it's it seems as though client support sort of proceeds at a fairly glacial pace. There are always holdouts in every single environment. Windows interop. I think all these things sort of stop it being. It seems like a great solution for projects when someone is building a large storage system to do a specific project. Then they'll think very hard and use PNFS. And when it's something that's used for many purposes, then maybe it's not under consideration right now.
Okay. All right, thanks. I have another question, but what I'll do is get in the line again.
Okay.
To be fair.
Okay. Thanks, Amish. Thank you for the presentation. It was interesting. So, in terms of solutions to the problems that you have discussed, you know, what role do you think integrating with virtualization? Has. So, for example, if you integrate with the hypervisors and figure out, okay, this I/O is coming from this virtual machine versus that virtual machine, I mean, is that going to solve some of the scale-out issues in terms of you know, better knowledge of how you can handle fine-grained coherency and locking and all that?
Yeah, a great question. So I think there are a couple of points of relevance here. So we can use virtualization as a way of, so if I'll find some one of these stack pictures here. So we can use virtualization as an effective way of offloading this relatively CPU-intense part of what we do into a more scalable compute resource, right? Relying on your storage to provide a compute resource that's scalable, it's not very addressable, right? You'd rather be able to scale the compute independently. And separating it at this point or this point in the stack and saying that stuff can live in virtual machine containers and we can gain CPU scalability against our file storage in that way is pretty attractive. And also because it gives us a basic way of doing hardware service that doesn't disrupt client connections. So back to this question right here, right? There's a lot of relevance in taking parts and moving them inside virtual machine containers. And when we do that, individual virtual machines in combination would be creating the illusion of a large file store. And so I think it's a really interesting area. That is a form of disaggregation, which is something that I believe in pretty well, because I think that, you know, in this world where we're trying to scale CPU and RAM and SSD and disk in all exactly the right proportions to fit a workload or the projections of what a workload's going to look like 6 months into the future, generally it's more satisfying to be able to break those up into different containers that you can scale independently. So I think there's a lot of relevance.
Thank you.
Okay, so you talked about two ways of providing high availability. One is sort of pairing up the controllers and you know, the more traditional way of having redundancy within each node with dual-ported access.
Right.
Right. And the other is to have sort of RAID across the network, you know, with mirroring or erasure coding.
Right.
And you seem to suggest that the second is more scalable, like it's from going from two nodes to N nodes, right? But you could imagine, even with the first mode of scaling, you could have N pairs collaborating to create a scale-out cluster. Do you see any problem with that kind of approach?
So I'll break this down into different concerns, I guess. If we're talking about the creation of an external SAN has hardware redundancy built into it, it's complexity that can be undesirable in a lot of situations. And so I think there's sort of there's an aesthetics objection that I have to that. But could I build a scale-out system where we're still connecting through a SAN and everyone has subdivided the storage, or every individual node is subdividing the storage and accessing that through a SAN, through some sort of network switch fabric? Yeah, absolutely. That's completely reasonable to do. I don't like the HUD. I like direct attached storage in that world because I think, okay, at this point, why do I have a SAN? What's in it for me? I think that one of the things that you get is storage. I'm never going to get there with all these builds. But one of the things that you get is storage efficiency. So in this, you know, any place where I share disks, I can RAID across disks rather than across nodes, and I don't have this problem where protection overhead is very high on small scale out systems, and so that's really desirable. Does that answer your question?
Somewhat, and I'll talk to you more about it later.
Okay.
Thanks.
I actually have a question while people are still thinking. So some of the problems you mentioned here, they seem to be at the intersection of the network and the storage, because you have to go through all the networking to actually reach the storage. Do you think we can do something on the client side to make the client more aware, and then the client side protocol be saying, oh, by the way, stop talking to this machine, talk to this machine now, and even switch the connection from the client side? So why not offload some smartness into the client?
Yeah, and I think that, so I make the argument that distributed file system, NFS or SMB, is more attractive than client-side drivers because there's a large-scale software upgrade problem for administrators when you put stuff on the client side. But the wildfire success of Dropbox belies that notion in a way, because, you know, Dropbox takes off because people are willing to install a custom file system access module onto arbitrary pieces of equipment. I think that if you overcome that basic objection, then yeah, you can. There are things that you can do a lot better. Now, there are some, you do need to have protection for metadata, I think, to sort of be a generally viable solution. So having it so that, you know, having each of the endpoint machines participate in a SAN where they can corrupt metadata willy-nilly on the SAN would not be a good solution. But assuming that you could deal with that problem, I think there's a lot of benefit there. And it does eliminate a lot of network problems along the way.
Okay. I was actually just saying just moving the connection problems and not giving any metadata control to the client. I think that is more riskier, I agree.
Yes. I think that's true. Yeah.
Okay.
If you can get people to install, I welcome you to try to get people to install the software. But
I think in this, it's a research community. If they come up with a client that improves the performance by 2x, then I think eventually it may take off.
Thanks for the talk.
Thanks, Ajay.
I was curious when you were talking about low commit latencies or low write latencies with NVRAM. And it's true that NVRAM is really powerful on the storage, shared storage side, right? But I'm just wondering, does NVRAM really solve the problem when you have sustained writes? Or if you have bursty writes? Are we just using NVRAM to get best case? Or NVRAM, does it contribute only to the best case and not to the average or worst case?
Yeah, so I think that if I understand the question correctly, it alludes a little bit to something that Amesh said last year in his keynote, which was, it's like a sink that you're filling and there's a small drain on the bottom, right? And it's like you can keep filling it until you get to the top of that. You don't have that problem if the bandwidth to the NVRAM is greater than the sum of the bandwidth to all of the underlying storage devices, because by definition, you can always, the plug is bigger than the tap, right? Oh, sorry, the sink, what's that thing called? Anyway, so whatever, it always drains faster than it fills regardless. And that's part of that secret sauce, right? So whatever we end up with as our new source of low latency commit is going to need to be faster than the bandwidth of all of the storage that it's connected to. And if you, I have high hopes that I can easily believe that something like NVDIMM, which is, you know, NAND flash backed DRAMs with an external power source, is sufficient to outperform everything else in storage in your system. And so it's a worthy candidate for something like that. But it would have to have that property, right? It would need to have almost RAM performance in order to have that property. Otherwise, as you say, you're gonna end up filling up the NVRAM and then everything slows down at that point.
Thanks.
Okay, I actually have another question while people are still thinking. So you mentioned these data management problems where you say if you run this LS or DU, these operations, and they're mostly single-threaded and it can take multiple days. Do you think we should start thinking about storage devices talking networking protocols? Because in networking, people have solved problems where if you want to copy a large file from multiple sources, you can use BitTorrent today.
Right.
And if everybody talks that protocol, you can get the file fairly quickly.
Yep.
So do you think maybe when we are designing distributed storage, the storage node should talk some well-known networking protocols that now you can invoke from the client side, and then you can get the data really fast?
Yes. I think that's a great example of something where the inherently parallel nature of saying, okay, this thing's divided into chunks, here's what the index looks like, these are all the places need, you can go get them. Those sorts of approaches are going to help a lot. I think that we need to figure out what the analog is to that in the backup world, right? And I just want a pristine copy of this. I know there's a parallel async project that I think works reasonably well. So there is progress that has been made, and I think there's still a lot of room to go there. But I think that there's, beyond just taking ideas that we have today and then parallelizing them, there's definitely the opportunity to come up with bigger ideas.
Okay. Any more questions or comments? Okay, I think let's thank the speaker once again. And
thank you, everybody.